Welcome to the Health from Zanzi podcast, where we bring you inspiring stories of individuals making a significant impact in their communities. Today, we share the remarkable journey of Dr. Janine Josias, a passionate advocate for survivors of sexual violence. Her career spanning over three decades reflects not just a profession, but a profound calling. In this episode, we explore the unwavering dedication of this compassionate advocate for justice. As Dr. Josias recounts her journey, it's evident that her story goes beyond a mere career. It's a lifetime commitment. Janine, thank you so much for joining us here on the Health from Zanzi podcast. It is a pleasure to be able to welcome you. And we just love to hear more about the work that you're doing day to day. And so just understanding what the day in the life of Janine is. I think you work in an area that's very difficult to work in. So maybe just as an introduction, more about you and a bit about yourself. Thanks.
I'll be 60 this year. I'm a medical doctor for 34 years, and I've worked exclusively with survivors of sexual violence since 2004. Mm-hmm. Well, that will make it, this year will be my 20th year, actually. You know, when you start off as a health worker, as a doctor, you don't always know what is your niche in medicine. I didn't know what my niche was. All I knew was that I have to speak up for my patient. I have to stand in the gap for my patient. I have to advocate for my patient. At med school, I saw a lot of human rights of patients violated by our teachers, you know, our lecturers that had the audacity to come and teach us bedside manners of the doctor, but they didn't implement it. And when you ask them questions, they would actually send you off the ward round. It's ridiculous. And I mean, we still talk about that today. And I speak to my colleagues. I speak to medical students that come and job shadow. It's a bit better, but there's just a lot of entitlement and like the right that consultants and specialists have to abuse medical students, be that for doctors, for nurses, for occupational therapists, radiographers, you know, all of that. And then also for our patients. Patients are already in a vulnerable position. They are dependent on the doctor. You've got this whole power thing, you know, with a doctor that thinks that they know it all. I just knew when I was at med school and when I started to actually work that there is something seriously wrong with the system. And survivors of sexual violence, particularly for me, were victimized even more by the Department of Health. I am not even talking about SAPS. I'm not talking about the community. I'm not talking about the families. I'm talking about as health workers, we're supposed to help. We're supposed to make it better. We're supposed to not do harm. You know, all these ethical guidelines and Hippocratic oath. And I just felt that survivors of sexual violence really bear the brunt. And a lot of times they couldn't speak up for themselves because they were already violated in a very intimate space. And then to still be able to stand up for yourself when you are again and again and again violated by your family, by the police officer, by the doctor, by the nurse, by the social worker, by the court, you know, by your prosecutor, by the defense attorney, by the magistrate. I sort of landed in this job, not by default. In 2004, I had two kids under the age of four. My son just turned four. My daughter just turned two. I wasn't coping, you know, to be at work at 8 a.m. in the morning. And I asked the nursing sister at the time, who was my facility manager, if I could start off post 8, you know, or 9 o'clock. And I said, Sister Anthony, I will not take tea, you know, I will not take lunch. I'll take a 15-minute lunch break instead of 45 minutes. She said, no, you have to be at work at 8. I said, you know, I've got two kids. I'm not coping. So then I saw this job being advertised for Doctors Without Borders, Medicine Sans Frontières, MSF. It's a humanitarian aid organization, and they were looking for a doctor to work in sexual violence in Khayelitsha. So I phoned them up and I said, listen, before I'm going to do an application, come for an interview, can I start, you know, at office 8 or 9? They said, no, it's fine. You can start at 10. I said, okay, I will, because that is all I wanted. I just wanted to be at work a bit later that I could get my kids sorted. So I went for the job interview. I got the job because I knew that I had enough skill. I worked in Khayelitsha from 1992 until 2000. So I knew the landscape. Then I started with them, with MSF, June 2004. And my job was to start a center for survivors of sexual violence or rape. Because what they found was that at the time they were starting this whole thing about giving ARVs. And there was a big issue about, can people in a resource-limited setting actually take ARVs? Because at the time it was expensive and available easily, like in the state sector. So what happened was Doctors Without Borders was when they interviewed patients and asked them, how do you think you became HIV positive? Some people answered and said, I was raped. I did not know that I had to get post-exposure prophylaxis within 72 hours of the rape. I didn't know where to go. MSF then felt that they should start a service for survivors of sexual violence so that they could market this issue of the 72-hour period, that if you've been raped, you need to access life-saving post-exposure prophylaxis, or what we call PEP, within 72 hours of the rape. So that was then where I came into the picture. So we started. I started with them in June 2004, and then on the 4th of August 2004, we opened our center at Site B in Khayelitsha, and we called it the Simalela Center. And the word Simalela means to lean on somebody. You lean on somebody to help you. So we started the center on the 4th of August. It was Doctors Without Borders. And then I asked, but where do patients go in Khayelitsha that have been sexually violated? Do they go to the emergency unit? Do they go to the outpatients department? And then I found that they actually go to the GF USTA hospital in Manenberg at the time. I did further inquiries. And then they said, no, there's a center called the Tutuzela Center. I went to USTA. I looked up the center and I asked, can I do sessions? Yeah. Because, you know, I would like to just find out what exactly you do. And they were happy to have me on board because, look, I didn't ask for any money. I just said, I just want to come and help at the center and learn. So that is what I did. And I realized that 50% of the patients that they actually see at Manenberg, at GF Juista, came from Khayelitsha. So the sensible thing would be to then open a center that is in the area of Khayelitsha. So we spoke to MSF. MSF has funding. And they said, no, it is fine. We can open a center in Khayelitsha. So we just had chats with the SAPs. We had a chat with the detectives. They were very, very happy that we would have a center in Khayelitsha, because that would mean that they don't have to take the patients all the way to Manenberg, wait for the patients and so on. And we spoke to the social workers and they were very happy that there would be a center in Khayelitsha, because that would obviously save them having to fetch the clients, or if a client is to be removed, they have to go to Manenberg to fetch the patient and so on. The only people that were not happy about this move was the NPA. It was the National Prosecuting Authority, and they came down on me massively. And I didn't know that this center was the first center in South Africa, and it was a pilot center of the National Prosecuting Authority. And they said, but this is not fair. You know, you can't just open a center in Khayelitsha. If you're going to open a center in Khayelitsha, you're going to interfere with our numbers, with our data collection. I said, listen, at the end of the day, you must do what is best for the patient. Because when the Khayelitsha patients went to the center, they would have to wait, because now there would be other patients from Manenberg, from Athlone, from Nyanga, Guguleni, Tulanga, Bontival. And I said, you know, I thought that the NPA would be happy if we have a similar center in Khayelitsha. So I didn't know that this was part of a big national partnership, you can call it, between the health department, the NPA, the SAPS, and social development. So what the center in essence is, it is a one-stop center where survivors of sexual violence, and you can hear the word I use, It's not a victim, it's a survivor. A victim is the person that did not survive the rape. That person would land in a mortuary. It was survivors of sexual violence who could get all the services under one roof without being sent from pillar to post. And they had two outcomes that they wanted to achieve. The first one was to reduce secondary victimization. And the second outcome was to increase the conviction rate of rapists, because our conviction rate was pathetic. It still is, I can tell you, it's 8.4%. I think at the time it was 6 or 7%. So that was their ultimate goal. And this model, it was pushed by the NPA. So when I did a bit of thinking about the research about this model, it is not easy to push up your conviction rate because so many survivors do not actually make it to the point where their court case is finalized. So what they had to do was to look at the obstacles in the way of the rape survivor in order for them to get to the court so that their case can be finalized. So with the one-stop center, their aim was to remove all these obstacles in the path of the rape survivor so that they can get to the point of the court case being finalized so that the conviction rate can be increased. And this is what they hoped or still hope or achieving with having this one-stop center. So that is, in essence, what the Thuthuzela Center is. So as I said, we started the center on the 4th of August, 2004. We could not use the word Thuthuzela because that word belongs to the NPA. It is their name because they have to start the center. So we opted to call it the Simelane Center. And we told NPA, we're having a center. Can you give us NPA officials? They said, no, there is money for it, no budget at the time. But, you know, obviously we didn't wait for NPA to come to the party. NPA only started with us almost 8 years later. If we had to wait for you to come to the party, what would have happened to the 8,000 patients, which we saw from 2004 until 2011, 2012. So we worked at the center. I worked at the center till 2009. Doctors Without Borders then pulled out. I was taken over by the Department of Health, and I worked there until 2019. And then I was asked to come and work at the Thuthuzela Center, Bellville, and I am still based at the Thuthuzela Center, which is located in Kolbrim Hospital in Bellville. So that is where I am now. So I'm here 5 years now, the Kolbrim Thuthuzela Center.
Definitely, you've given us so much to do with how the Thuthuzela Centers came about and more what you do. And maybe I want to just bring it back, maybe one step before that, just to kind of understand the current situation when it comes to women and children's safety in South Africa. Maybe telling us about the issues. I think there's so many, you know, reports that come into the media to say South Africa has a high prevalence of sexual violence, all of these facts behind it. But understanding what the crisis is and the issues is essentially what is important, I think. So I'd like to just start with that as well, please. Thank you so much.
I'm not very good with all these stats because you get different stats depending who you speak to and what research has been done and when it has been done and how many people were interviewed and so on. I can tell you from my point of view as someone that is working at the coalface. And when I talk, it's because these are things that we see on a daily basis. I can definitely tell you that things have become much worse. The safety nets for our children is dysfunctional. It's fragmented. The services that are supposed to be there for survivors of sexual violence have gone. It might seem as if things have become better, but if you really look in depth, it is becoming worse because we have a shortage of health workers. We have a shortage of police officers. We have a big shortage at the courts. We're supposed to have sexual offences courts. We have a huge shortage of social workers. And because of these networks, you know, and the safety nets not being staffed adequately or resourced adequately, our rape survivors, and if I talk rape survivors, I am also talking about men, because we have many male rape survivors, adults and kids. And it is very difficult for our adult males to come forward because of the stigma, the obstacles, and because so many people think that males cannot be raped or that not a lot of adult males are raped. That is one of the biggest misconceptions that you can find. And also a lot of our services are very focused on females. Like example is here at our Tutuzela Center, all our lay counselors are female. Our nurses are female. Luckily, we've got 3 male doctors that are working on the roster, but office hours, it's myself and a male doctor, and I've got 1 male intern. But the service is very female dominant, and that also puts off a lot of men to come forward. I can tell you that the current situation is dire. If you look at sexual violence, you know, I always say it's a big elephant and you have to eat it from all sides. Like, we cannot just give medication to people that have been raped. We have to look at the prevention side of it. And that is a big angle, because you have to go right back to what are the causes of patriarch inequality, like the remnants of like apartheid, all the different social ills that are there. Housing, the lack of like recreation facilities. We've got schools that are full. There are 40 kids in a class. And then you expect that one teacher to still identify a child could possibly have been sexually violated or that has issues at home. That teacher is so busy, they don't even have the time. I've got teachers that come in and say, you know, doctor, I could see that there was something wrong with this child, but there are so many things I'd have to do in order to get that child to you. Sometimes we just don't have the time. You know, sometimes I listen on the radio or on the TV when they say our families have fallen apart, the typical father, mother, 2 kids. That is a myth. I mean, we've got so many single-headed households. Even before the HIV epidemic, so many single-headed households, and then most of them are female-headed. So that typical thing of the family, like we need to nurture the way the family should be, that is gone. You know, we need to accept that there are many single-headed households. We've got single parents. We have many female single parents. They don't get logical support from the father figure. So what do we do about that than to now talk all the time to say that we need to go back to the way our families used to be structured? That is not going to happen. I mean, more and more you get people that divorce. We get women that actually opt not to get married because they can see what is actually happening in married life if they look at the family members, colleagues, and so on. So, you know, I always think, you know, why do you talk about the past? See what is happening now and how can we assist and empower and like resource these single-headed households. So as I said, there are many causative factors, the prevention aspect of that. Simple things like young girls, when they get pregnant, they will just leave the school because they can't look after their babies and be at school. I know that the education department advocates that the girl children must go back to school. But that is only if they've got a good social support at home, which does not always happen. So what are the options, you know? And like, who keeps like a database of those girls? So we have those young girls, like women, coming to us here as rape survivors. And once you start to take the history or the family history, then you just realize, you know, where do you start with this girl? You know, who do you call on to support this child? So we do refer to the social workers, we refer to the NPOs, but the load is so big and there are not enough hands on deck. There are not enough resources in order to assist that girl to become financially independent. So, I mean, it is like a vicious cycle. You know, another big issue is the substance like use. It is so easy to get tuck, cannabis, ecstasy, buttons, whatever they call these drugs. Everybody knows where you can find it. And we've got so many young people that are hooked on substances and it just goes from one disaster to another. What do we do about that? So sometimes when you sit here, then you sit with a survivor and you ask yourself, you know, where do I start? You know, whose eye is on this child? Who is actually looking after this survivor in the family, in the house, in the community? And sometimes the answer is very, very sad. In a nutshell, to me, the situation for safety for our women, and as I said, we also need to talk our men, children, which obviously includes boys and girls. It is really dire.
As I'm listening to you again, Janine, it's just showcasing the heavy weight in your shoulders, just with this understanding and knowledge of what the situation actually is. What other aspects should we be talking about? So my next question would also be public awareness campaigns, community engagement, the root causes of violence in South Africa.
For me, it's the political will is not there. We've got a lot of patriarchy when it comes to our politicians. The case of Zuma and Kwesi is a very good example where the ANC Women's League supported Zuma and did not believe this young woman. Unfortunately, she has passed on. But I mean, that to me was just exactly what is happening in government, that you have to justify why you need services for people that have been raped. But then also, you know, sometimes when I sit at the center, you know, then I say to myself, you know what, you are sitting here and waiting for people to be raped. And then you help them. It is too late. You know, we should be at the point where people do not get raped in the first place. The thing is that perpetrators, rapists know that the systems are dysfunctional, that our justice system, I call it an injustice system, our system is failing our survivors, our victims, and their families. We see about 180 people here a month, which means I should be caught almost every day. I get called to a court maybe once every second week. We want NPA and the Department of Justice to give us the real statistics. How many of the patients that we see here actually get justice at the end of the day? Even with this model being here, this Tutuzela modeling here, there are still many obstacles in the way of that person getting the day in court and getting justice. We have so many complaints, patients coming back to us saying to us, you advise me to lay a charge with the police. You know, I came here and you advise us and then we call the police. But now just see what is happening. I am still waiting on the detective. They haven't called me. My case is at court, but it's been postponed 6 times, 7 times. The DNA is not yet available. So people just, at the end of the day, just give up. You know, and sometimes at the center now, we are at the point sometimes where we say to ourselves, do we really advise people to lay a formal charge with the police, knowing all the obstacles that they are going to meet on their way? Shouldn't we rather, when the person comes here, see that we give them psychosocial support, build them up psychologically so that they can face the world after what has happened to them? Because if we advise them to lay a charge with the police, then it goes to court. Because of the dysfunctionality of those systems, those patients get victimized again and again and again, which is exactly what the center was started for, was to reduce secondary victimization. But because of the other systems not functioning, we are actually doing what the Tutuzela is not standing for. So I think if there is political will, understanding of what is rape, understanding what are the causes of it, then we will get more focus on the prevention aspects. We will get more focus on the management of somebody that has been raped. We will get more resources being pumped into schools, into social systems, into the education sector, into employment, housing, into safe spaces, into the health sector, into the police, criminal justice sector. It starts with political will, because that is how resources are allocated.
Yeah, it is never a straight kind of answer when it comes to these things, because there's so many aspects and areas to consider, all plays to take note of and consider. There's no working in silos, but somehow that is currently what's happening. People aren't really working well enough together.
No, you're right. We are working in silos. We don't have one database that connects that patient from the point where they enter the system at the steps, be it at a medical facility, be it at school, a social worker. Our systems are not connected. And that is how our survivors fall through the cracks. And the same with perpetrators. You know, the perpetrators have a field day in South Africa because they know that the systems are dysfunctional. perpetrators will say to that rape victim, you are now going to get into a bath. I'm going to put some antiseptic in, wash your panty, bath yourself. Because they know what we are going to do at the hospital, that we're going to collect evidence. They rape with condoms because they know that when they come here, that we are going to collect DNA samples. They know how to beat the system. Another issue is we've got so many people in South Africa that are not documented. I am not only talking about people coming from the north of South Africa. We even have South Africans that are not on the system. They don't have a birth certificate. They don't have an ID. So what actually links that person to the system? Fingerprints. And I mean, even that system is not up and running. So perpetrators know that they will get away with it. If you sometimes listen on the TV, they will say, this person was caught because he is a serial rapist. He raped 30 women. He raped 60 women. He raped 18 women. I mean, really, it shouldn't happen. Once a person is in the system and SAPS do what they're supposed to do and the other departments do what they are supposed to do, that perpetrator should have been caught much earlier. Many a times it is up to the community to then inform SAPS that they have seen this person here or that they suspect this, whereas we should be having SAPS intelligence doing these things. I go to court to testify in these cases. You know, I had a case recently. DNA is positive on the survivor. But the arguments in court, they will talk things about, but it's the neighbor. Are you sure it was a neighbor? What did she tell you? Is it the neighbor? I said, that cuts no ice, you know, whether she said it's the neighbor or whether she said it's someone that stays four streets away. That is not the issue. That DNA is positive. The DNA shouldn't be there in the first place, but it is there. Why do you still argue about these other issues? So even our system in court, our justice system, is not on the side of the survivor. I know that they talk about reasonable doubt. But I mean, if you've got positive like DNA linking the suspect to the survivor, what more do you want? Just feel that the system is not survivor supportive or friendly. You know, you just basically have to court and fight your own case, you know, and prove that you were raped.
It kind of touches on so many aspects. What is the solution here? If there is anything that we can start thinking about in terms of that. Earlier, you talk about these services at the Tutuzela Care Center specifically that might help. Are there certain wins? You know, I don't know.
I can say to you, this is a very good model if it is functioning the way it is supposed to be on paper. If I think back in the late 80s, in the 90s, when there was no centers like these, systems were bad. I am not just talking from the Department of Health, SAP Social Development and the court. At least now, when we've got the Tutuzela Center, there is some measure of coordination. It is definitely not enough. Even with the four of us as the main stakeholders, oh yes, I must include the NPO sector. They are very important. Actually five, it's SAPS Health, Social Development, it's the courts, NPA Justice, and then the NPO sector. Even with all these people on board, because the services are not a resource adequately, accountability is not enough. That is why it is not functioning optimally, and that is why we still get secondary victimization. If I look back to like where we come from, it is much better. However, we need many more such centers. In the Western Cape, we have 9 centers. How many hospitals are in the Western Cape? Hundreds. How many police offices are there or stations? Or what they call now a CSC, which is a community service center. Hundreds. We only have 9 centers in the whole of the Western Cape. In South Africa, we have something like 63 centers. We should have had over 1,000 centers by now. You know, why did they not open up more centers? Once again, political will, resources, and then obviously we have to think about the corruption that has been happening before the ANC came into power. But I mean, it is much more obvious now. We all know what has happened in our government. So then what happens is that they then take like resources away from the Department of Health, from education, from social development, from the police, from key service providers in the community. At the hospitals, we feel it. Our surgeries are being postponed. Operations are being postponed. Our waiting time just to get a scope is not going to be like 6 weeks or 2 months. It's going to be 6 months. It's going to be 9 months, 12. So we feel it at the coalface. And then who suffers? It is people that cannot pay medical aid. We know what the effect of corruption is at the end of the day. The people that suffer are the people that just do not have.
You know, there's much to be said about how we can improve, what we need to do moving forward. Perhaps you could just like leave us with a closing message. Is there a way to do a little bit of something small, contribute my time, donate?
Civil society needs to continue to be active. Civil society has got a lot of power, and I think sometimes we underestimate our power. I mean, they assisted with getting ARVs to resource limited settings. You know, if I just think of Zaki Ahmed and TAC, I mean, civil society pushed and pushed, you know, government had to give in. So that is the first thing for me. What I always say is that we cannot wait until all the systems are functioning optimally. So in the meantime, like we have to do things in parallel, get involved in the community, like awareness, like you are doing now. Thanks for that. See how you can assist people with like advice. You know, I feel that we need to open our old advice centers again. At each school, we should have volunteers that the kids can go and talk to, you know, because they are social workers, but like you get one social worker for 15 to 20 schools. So at that school level, if there is somebody that the kids can go and at least talk to. Another thing is like our food kitchens, our soup kitchen. A lot of kids don't have food at home. They don't have food security. This is something we see here at the Tutuzela. No, if people come, the first thing they will say, isn't there a cup of coffee or isn't there a sandwich or a stuck in brood or something? People are hungry. So if you do that in the communities, you can help that child to then focus on their schoolwork. Or then you can help that family not to resort to like illegal means in which to get food into the house. If you look like at the faith sector, churches, mosques, synagogue, that should be safe spaces, you know, like where people can go to just to like get some help or like advice. And then these faith institutions can then link them to services because, you know, a person find that churches and the mosques like have become white elephants in the community, whereas they could be multi-purpose centers. So yes, there's a lot of things that we can do until such time that we can say one day there is no more rape in our societies. I wish I can say that like in my lifetime. But there is hope always, you know, we just cannot give up. It might sound bad, but there is always hope. In this country, there is a lot of very good people. We've got active people, we've got activists, and that is what keeps us going at the Tutuzela Center, because we know that we have support out there.
In the face of adversity, Dr. Janine Josias stands as a beacon of hope for survivors, tirelessly advocating for a system that truly supports and protects those who have already endured so much. Her calling for society to rethink its approach to survivors resonates, urging us all to work collectively towards a world where, as she passionately asserts, people do not get raped in the first place. Thank you, Dr. Josias, for your unwavering dedication and commitment to making a positive impact in the lives of survivors. Remember, you can visit www.healthfromzanzi.co.za for more on this topic. From me, Dor Numdu, our technical producer Megan van de Vent, and the rest of the hashtag Team Food from Zanzi, until next time, stay inspired.